Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode of Crime and Science Radio. Today's show is called Forensic Science on Trial with the Honorable Donald Shelton on Forensic Science and the Courts. So now, everybody, without any further ado, here is your host of the show, Jan Burke and Doug Lyle.
Well, welcome, everyone. We have a terrific show for you today. We're going to speak to the Honorable Donald Shelton, who is currently the director of the Criminal Justice Program at the University of Michigan. He served as the chief judge in the 22nd Judicial Court in Washtenaw County Trial Court, and he had been a circuit court judge there from 1990 until his retirement from the bench just last year. In addition to his law degree, he has advanced degrees in criminology, criminal justice, and judicial studies, and he's taught at the college level since 1971. He's the author of numerous books and studies on forensic science evidence in the judicial system, which we're going to talk about tonight. Two of his most recent works are Forensic Science in the Court and Forensic Science Evidence, Can the Law Keep Up with Science? So welcome to the program, Don.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure, Jan, and you too, Doug.
Well, Don, it's great to have you here. We're kind of old friends. We've been on panels together and fooled around together and had a good time up in Book Passage and all that. You've got an amazing career, and, you know, we're going to post all this stuff online. Now, Jan covered the high points, but your career is much more stellar than that, and it would take us like an hour to go through all of it. But our listeners know that we post this stuff online. But let's just kind of start at the beginning. What attracted you to study law and enter that profession in the first place? How did you end up there?
Well, you know, law school really was my greening. I'll date myself. I graduated from law school at the end of the 60s, and it seemed like everything in the world that was happening in the law at that time. And I was the first person in my immediate family to even graduate from high school, much less go to college or law school. So I came out of school with a determination that I wanted to find some way in this world to help people, and especially people like my family who didn't have a lot of money or a lot of position in society, and that led me into the law.
And then after you wound your way through all of that, you ended up going to the bench, not in the Major League Baseball sense, but in the legal sense, which is a good place to be. And so what attracted you to secure a judgeship, and how did you go about doing that from mere lawyer,
believe
so to
it
speak,
or not,
to a judge?
Being a judge was never anything that I planned to do. I had been asked by the governor, it was Governor Blanchard at that time, to chair a committee to find an appointment for a judge who had retired. And we met and finally came up with a couple of good candidates. And he called one day and said, I see you've come up with these candidates. I said, yes, what do you think? And he said, well, I have a better idea. I want you to do it. And frankly, that was the first time in my life that I even considered becoming a judge. And after I thought about it, I reverted to the reason I went into the law. I saw it as an opportunity to help people in a more direct way than as a lawyer, and accepted his request, and he appointed me as a judge in 1990.
Well, so for our listeners who haven't been in civics classes for a while, what is a circuit court, and what kinds of cases are brought before a circuit court?
Well, in Michigan, the circuit court is the trial court, but it's the level of court that only deals with serious cases. On the civil side, we handle cases that involve more than $25,000 up to an unlimited amount. But on the criminal side, we only handle felonies, meaning crimes that are punishable by more than a year in prison up to what Michigan calls capital punishment, which is life in prison without the possibility of parole.
So as somebody who's spent this amount of time as a judge, what do you wish the public better understood about courts and the work of judges?
Well, I think the public, because of the way that it's portrayed to them, view justice as something that's simple and can be answered with blanket answers. What I learned on the bench is that justice, criminal justice, to be justice, has to be personal, that every case is different, and that the answers to crime are not simple. One of the things I tell my students is that if they think the answer is simple, they probably didn't understand the question. In court, we end up making decisions. The judge ends up making decisions that are going to change a lot of people's lives, not just the defendant, but the victim, and indeed the safety of the whole community. And that's a decision that has to be made on a personal case-by-case basis. And so when we get carried away and adopt things like mandatory sentences, it means that in many cases those sentences are going to be unjust because they aren't tailored to the crime or to the criminal.
Well, I distinctly remember our first meeting, which was at an annual NIJ meeting, and you were speaking about a phenomenon that gets talked a lot about, especially by prosecutors, called the CSI effect. And you were presenting, certainly the first I had ever seen, one of the first scholarly studies about juror expectations in the post-CSI world. So tell us about the CSI effect and how your team of researchers studied it and what your study revealed.
Well, the so-called CSI effect is the feeling expressed by lawyers, particularly prosecutors and some judges, that jurors were suddenly acquitting people who were guilty when they didn't see the kind of evidence that they saw on CSI and similar forensic science television shows. That it was because of watching those shows that jurors had unreasonable expectations for scientific evidence from the prosecutor. And the prosecutor said, when the jurors didn't see that, they, as they said it, wrongfully acquitted individuals. So I wondered, is that true? Because I had heard similar comments from jurors. I interviewed the jurors after every case I tried, and they made comments about the lack of scientific evidence. One of my favorite quotes was a juror who said, well, the police did a sloppy job. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, they didn't even dust the lawn for fingerprints. And that sort of comment led to these anecdotes blaming television shows for acquittals. And I wondered if that was really true. After all, these were mainly anecdotes, and frankly, the complaints were all coming from losers. People
right.
who had lost the case and were searching for some reason why they lost it. So we set out with two other researchers from Eastern Michigan University to do a statistical study to see if that was true. And we surveyed over 1,000 actual jurors as they came into court before they'd been given instructions. And we wanted to find out three things. One is, what were their expectations for scientific evidence? Secondly, would they really demand scientific evidence as a condition of a guilty finding? And third, was that because of the television shows they watched? So we conducted that study in Washtenaw County and with these 1,047 jurors. The results were that indeed we did find that the jurors had high expectations for scientific evidence, certainly higher than we thought existed in the past. Some of those expectations were amazing. We found that 42% of the jurors expect to see DNA evidence in every criminal case.
Mm.
Now, if you think about that, that's almost 5 out of every 12 jurors who start a trial thinking that the prosecution is going to present DNA. 60% of the jurors almost expect to see some kind of scientific evidence in every criminal case, not just particular types of criminal cases. So the first finding was that indeed juror expectations for scientific evidence are high. Secondly, we found that jurors will, certainly in some cases, demand to see scientific evidence before they'll find the person guilty, which is what the prosecutors, part of what the prosecutors were claiming. But the third part was very interesting. The third thing was that the jurors' expectations and demands had nothing to do with what television programs they watched. The people who watched CSI or similar programs didn't expect or demand any more scientific evidence than people who didn't watch those programs. So the question was, well, if it's not television programs, what is it that's causing these increased expectations and demands for scientific evidence? And I posited the theory, and it was a theory at that study, that we called the tech effect. That blaming television, was a few television shows, is just too simplistic. The real reason why jurors, the theory went, are expecting and demanding more scientific evidence is cultural changes that have taken place over the last 30 years in our society. That ordinary people now know more about forensic science than they ever learned in school. It's become part of our culture. One of my favorite article titles is, What's DNA, Daddy? and just to show the level to which forensic science has, science in general, and forensic science in particular, has permeated our society. So it isn't just as simple as watching television and looking at guys in sunglasses getting immediate DNA results. It really is a sense that ordinary folks know that science is available. Now, all the information in the world we know isn't in Encyclopedia Britannica. It's in your pocket on that iPhone. And jurors, as with everyone else in our culture, know that that information, that science is available, and they expect the prosecution to prove it if they're going to ask these jurors to lock someone up, deprive them of their liberty, or perhaps even their lives. That was the theory. And we conducted a second study to explore whether our first study was valid and also to look at this question of a tech effect. And that's what led us to a second study in Wayne County, which is Detroit.
Right, and that second study was done as a follow-up. And obviously that is the Detroit area, so the demographics are a little different. Did that alter the outcome, change what you uncovered?
Well, the demographics were very different. My court is in Ann Arbor, was in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And, for example, the demographics there included the fact that 76% of our jurors had a college education. The demographics in Wayne County, where Detroit is, were very different. Interestingly, however, the results in terms of expectations and demands were almost identical in Wayne County. So the demographics made no difference at all. We did modify the study in Wayne County to try to test this theory we had about the tech effect and cultural changes. So one of the questions we asked people in Wayne County, we had over 1,200 jurors participate there, was what type of electronic equipment they had in their lives. Did they have a computer at work? Did they have a computer at home? Did they have a cell phone? Did the cell phone have access to the internet? Did they have a GPS? And what we found was that the more sophisticated electronic equipment jurors had in their everyday lives, the higher their expectations and demands were for scientific evidence, which tends to support this tech effect idea that it's really cultural changes that we've undergone and a reflection of our modern society rather than just a few television shows.
I think that's true, and I think the news media, obviously, because they hype all this stuff too, I think they're complicit in this in this misunderstanding also.
Well, the phrase CSI effect was coined by the media, not by the prosecutor, because CSI at that time was the most popular television show in the world, and it was one of those simple answers. And as I said before to my students, if you think the answer is simple, you probably don't understand the question.
Well, I remember many years ago during the Scott Peterson case, I was on court TV back when that was still alive. And, you know, they were obviously talking about forensic evidence, and I was asked two or three times, you know, what about DNA evidence? It's like, you know, you can't convict this guy of murdering his wife and unborn child without some scientific evidence. And I said, so what? It doesn't mean anything. If they found, you know, Lacey's blood all over Scott's pants, what difference does it make? They live together. You know, it's not the evidence. It's what does the evidence mean? And how does it connect, you know, dot A to dot B?
And that's really the burden of lawyers and experts to convey that to the jury. Interesting, one of our findings was that the biggest demand for DNA evidence that jurors expressed was in rape cases.
Mm-hmm.
That jurors were going to demand DNA evidence, they thought, at least going into a trial, before they would convict a person of rape. Now, the reality is that in most rape cases, the issue is not whether there has been sexual penetration, which is what DNA would reveal, but in most rape cases, the issue is not did it occur, but was it consensual, and or was the person, the victim at the time, capable of even of giving consent. But that's not the juror's perception, and the burden is on lawyers and experts to explain sometimes whether the forensic evidence is even relevant to their quest, to their decision.
That's true, and one of the first things they teach you in medical school is that rape is not a medical diagnosis. It's illegal. Yeah. It's a legal term. Exactly. What would you hope that from these studies, what would you hope that the public would take away from this? What's the one or two bullet points that you would hope that the listeners would say, oh, now I get it?
Well, I actually don't think, I think I'm realistic enough to not believe it's going to change the cultural phenomena. We're not going to change the cultural expectations for scientific evidence, nor do I think we should try, frankly. When jurors are saying we expect the prosecution to produce the type of evidence that's available, and if you don't, that's a reasonable doubt as to guilt. I think that there's nothing wrong with that. What's reasonable for jurors to expect the prosecution to prove is different now than it was 30 years ago. So I think the answer is that we're going to have to do two things in the court system, and that is that lawyers and law enforcement are going to have to get more forensic science evidence than they have in the past. And secondly, when they don't have it, they need to be prepared to explain why. They need to be able to explain, for example, to jurors that the fact that there were no fingerprints on the steering wheel doesn't mean that that person didn't touch the steering wheel. It just means that it didn't leave fingerprints. Those sort of explanations have to be built in, and it's going to take a much more nuanced approach to jurors because jurors are much smarter than they used to be, especially about science.
What about the attorneys that are involved in this, the prosecutors and defense attorneys? How did they welcome or not welcome this information? I mean, if they look at it as, whoa, wow, I didn't know this, I can use this, or it's kind of like quit interfering with my life, or somewhere in between.
mainly the latter.
This is why Don and I were like the lone rangers out there at that NIJ meeting that year.
Well, you know, the overwhelming response of prosecutors was, yeah, well, that's all well and good, you guys, with that scientific study, but we know how jurors really react, and it really wasn't because I did a poor job or didn't present enough evidence. It's because of that darn TV show. And it's that's been the reaction of prosecutors, but I think over the years since we did that initial study, prosecutors are coming around, and prosecutors are certainly understanding now that they can't just play dumb about forensic science evidence, because the jurors know that. And the same is true for defense lawyers. I used to hear lawyers on both sides stand up and say, well, I don't know anything about this technical computer stuff here. I can't even program the remote on my TV. And they did that because they thought it was cute and because
right.
they thought jurors would relate to it. Well, these jurors not only know how to program the remote on their TV, they know how to find the answer to scientific questions on their telephone. And they don't think it's cute anymore. What they really think is that either the government or the defendant is not getting very good representation. And I think both sides are starting to understand that a lot better.
Hmm. So this brings us to, I think, a big part of what you've studied in recent years. What do you see as the main problems in how we use forensic science in the criminal justice system?
Well, I think certainly the main problem was pointed out in the National Academy of Sciences report, and that is that there's a serious question about the scientific validity of the types of forensic science evidence that we have been presenting and that we as judges have been allowing. And that has come into the forefront in, first of all, in the DNA exonerations of the now almost 400 people that have been exonerated with the use of DNA. Over half of those people were originally convicted based on other forms of forensic science evidence. And that was what led us to this congressional study conducted by the National Academy of Sciences. But since that time, we have not moved far in finding better proof of the scientific validity or invalidity of the types of forensic science that we are have admitted in the past, and frankly, that judges are continuing to admit even today, in spite of the questions about their validity. So I think the biggest problem facing the forensic science community now is to find ways to demonstrate that the science we're allowing jurors to hear is valid, reliable science.
Well, let's hold that thought there. We'll be back in a moment after this break with more with the Honorable Donald Sheldon, and we look forward to talking to you more about forensic science and the courts.
Everybody, here we go. We got some great new stuff for you guys to check out. Author David Lyons is back with his latest book in his Jock Boucher series, Waters of Oblivion. This is the third book in the series, and it could possibly be the best. Here at Suspense Magazine, we call it a must-read, a great espionage thriller, so you need to check out davidlyonsauthor.com for a lot more information on this book and the rest of the series. Midnight Inc. is celebrating 10 years of great mystery suspense books, and we are always excited to receive a new Midnight Inc. book, just because we always know it's of the very highest quality with fabulous authors. Make sure that you visit midnightincbooks.com and discover some of those fabulous new authors to place on your shelf. Would you become a serial killer to save your child? Because that's one of the questions author Mike Pace asks in his latest book, One to Go. Steve Barry says terrific, ripping good, explosive excitement, says Douglas Preston, and relentlessly suspenseful, says John Land. So you need to visit MikePaceBooks.com for more information on that. Also, new from author Jamie Mason is Monday's Lie. Jamie placed her name solidly in the suspense genre with her last book, Three Graves Full, and Monday's Lie should appeal to fans of The Americans and Homeland. So do yourself a favor, check out Monday's Lie and visit Jamie on her website at jamie-mason.com. Don't forget the hyphen. Now, when Brad Thor calls your book awesome and one of the hottest authors in the thriller genre, you definitely need to start taking notice. And from Kensington Press is author Mark Cameron with his latest book, Day Zero. Also, Candace Fox brings horror abound in her latest book, Hades. So visit KensingtonBooks.com for a lot more on all of their titles. To catch a satanic killer, Detective Jennifer Mueller will go into the Devil's Reach. And that's the title of author Lewis Weinberg's latest book. It's graphic, gritty, wildly entertaining are just some of the words that are being used to describe this latest thriller. So make sure you go to Lewis Weinberger, WEINBERGER.com, for a lot more information on everything he's got going on. And just remember, we want to tell everyone to make sure that you check out all of our sponsors by visiting, too, SuspenseMagazine.com. You can get the magazine, see what all we have going inside. And thanks for all the support that you all guys do, because without you, we wouldn't have this radio show and these magazines. And we won't be able to bring this fine stuff to you. So, again, we want to thank all of you guys out there for listening and enjoy the show. And
join Stephen King, Peter Straub, Ellen Datlow, Ramsey Campbell, Jonathan Mayberry, and hundreds more in the Horror Writers Association's campaign, HorrorSelfies.com. Take a selfie with any written message promoting reading or with your favorite book. Check in at HorrorSelfies.com to submit your photo, and you can win signed books. Help us let the world know why horror is important and submit your selfie today. That's www.horrorselfies.com.
All it takes is the perfect shot. You can take your shot this year in New York City during the 10-year anniversary of Thriller Fest. Take aim during Craft Fest, Pitch Fest, Thriller Fest, and new this year, Career Fest, all designed to help you hit your mark. Meet the pros, like 2015 Thriller Master Nelson DeMille, Silver Bullet recipient Kathy Reichs, with spotlight guests Greg Isles, Charlene Harris, and Mark Billingham. And let the best help you zero in on your career target at the Grand Hyatt in New York City, July 7th through the 11th, 2015. It's time. Take your shot. Register now. www.thrillerfest.com.
Because we have some great discussion off the air with our special guest, Honorable Donald E. Shelton. Again, today's show is called Forensic Science on Trial, the Honorable Donald Shelton on Forensic Science and the Courts. So let's get back to the show with your hosts, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke, if they stop telling jokes. Here we go.
Well, Danielle, we were actually talking about something very serious before the break, so we'll try to get back to that tone. You mentioned validity, which is, you know, a concept. I think sometimes people who may not be aware that in the context of science, that essentially means that you're saying this tests what we say it tests, that this actually has meaning relative to what we say it means. And we've got, unfortunately, a lot of examples of ways in which that hasn't always been true. I mean, it's sort of the nature of science to come up with theories and test them and find out, you know, it's going to change. And just as we're not using leeches anymore in medical science,
right?
Too
actually,
often.
We are. But
we are. I was going to say that was a bad example, wasn't it? Okay, we're not bleeding people too often.
Exactly. Actually, but, we are in certain circumstances, but not. Yeah, yeah, you got it. Go ahead.
You know, there are certainly practices, we'll put it that way, that change as we learn more, and so that's going to happen to some extent. But it's not exactly what's happening. And you mentioned the National Academy of Sciences study. That's back in 2009 now. It's hard for me to believe that we've had 6 years. So what are some of the consequences of going with these areas of forensic science that may not really be grounded in science?
Well, one of the complaints that the National Academy of Sciences report really verified was that the underlying premises of many forms of our of scientific evidence, in particular the identification forms, have never been scientifically demonstrated or validated like we do in science that isn't connected with the criminal justice system. Handwriting, for example, or bite marks, for example. The premise of handwriting is that no two persons have the same handwriting. Is that true? Well, the reality is that we've never had any sort of scientific study to demonstrate whether handwriting is unique or not unique. Amazingly to some people, the same is true for fingerprints. The premise of all fingerprint testimony is that no two people have the same fingerprints. And yet, there has not been yet a body of scientific data or evidence that supports that premise. It's our intuition, it's our assumption, just like we assumed that the Earth was flat. But there's never been a scientific basis for that. And the same is true in several other areas. What the National Academy of Science challenged us to do was find out if there isn't a scientific basis that's been established, let's find out. Do the scientific studies to tell us whether these forms of scientific evidence are valid or not valid. Use the ordinary assumptions about science, like DNA that we have, to demonstrate whether this is reliable enough for the jury to take someone's life or take someone's liberty with.
Interesting. Well, this brings up another subject. I mean, when I was in college, half of my fraternity brothers were pre-law and half were pre-med, at least in the first 2 years.
Depending on whether they could stand the sight of blood or not.
And then, exactly. Well, the difference was is that the us pre-med students were actually in the science library studying. Pre-law students were out drinking and chasing women. So it brings up
the thing. Went to the University of Michigan, and that wasn't true.
In the courtroom with Daubert and Fry and all the other rules of evidence and stuff, the judge is actually the gatekeeper as to what's allowed in the courtroom. Are most judges suited to make that determination? And if not, what are the alternatives?
Well, my answer is yes, most judges are suited, but not in the way that you think. Judges are really the gatekeepers of all forms of evidence.
Right.
That judges have to decide whether the jury is going to hear certain evidence or not. And they make decisions. Those may be legal conclusions about whether something is hearsay, for example, and not admissible. But even in substantive areas, judges have to make decisions about whether evidence comes through the gate, meaning does the jury get to hear it, and we've always done that, even as to areas of expertise. For example, in my particular jurisdiction, I sat on a number of medical malpractice civil cases. I sat on a number of cases involving complaints of architectural negligence. I didn't go to medical school. I certainly didn't go to architecture school. But the process functions so that the lawyers, the adversaries, educate the judge on the issues, whether that happens to be about architecture or medicine or bite marks. They educate the judge, and then the judge makes that decision based on the evidence they hear. I used to say that my fellow judges didn't like me saying it, but I used to say that judges have to have a toilet mind. I better explain that. What I meant was that as to a particular issue, judges, like lawyers, have to fill their minds with all the information they can get about that particular issue in order to make a decision about whether that evidence is admissible in court. And once that issue is done, you flush it out of your mind and go on to the next issue. That's what we're taught. That's what we're taught in law school, and I hope that's something that all judges can do. When we talk about forensic science gatekeepers, a lot of people criticize that concept, saying, well, judges don't know anything about science. Why should they be the gatekeepers? Well, the answer is that our legal system operates on the basis that the judge has to make sure that whatever the jury hears as evidence in a case is relevant, meaning that it relates to the issue in the case. It's probative, meaning that it tends to prove an issue that's involved in the case. If the testimony from an expert is not based on reliable science and therefore isn't valid, then it's not probative. It's not anything the jury ought to hear. So eliminating junk science is something that judges are used to doing in their ordinary operation as gatekeepers. So I do think judges are capable of being gatekeepers. Now, do I think that they responsibly exercise that role in areas of forensic science? I'm afraid not.
Yeah. Well,
now, that's questions why, right?
Yeah. No, well, the old adage in computer is garbage in is garbage out. And in medicine, we always say bad data is worse than no data. It's better to know nothing than know the wrong thing. So a lot of the problems with evidence obviously begin before it ever gets dropped into your lab. Do you think that crime labs, the forensic science department, should be independent, regulated, controlled, and et cetera, et cetera? And how do you ensure, and I'm sure you run into this from both sides, that the evidence that the prosecution brings to you isn't cherry-picked, that they don't avoid bringing in things that...
Yeah, that certainly starts at the laboratory. Much of my work in the last few years has been focused on issues of cognitive bias in forensic science, unconscious bias, if you will, contextual bias, oftentimes in a lab. What I mean by that is it's one thing if the prosecutor or the police bring two fingerprints in and say, this is a fingerprint from the scene, this is a fingerprint from one of our suspects, and they leave. And then the forensic fingerprint examiner examines them and comes to a conclusion. What happens if the police come in and say, this is the fingerprint from the crime scene, and this is a fingerprint from our guy who's already confessed to doing it? What do you think? And that's a blatant one, but there certainly are conversations that take place, and that can lead to a contextual bias where you know what the answer is supposed to be before you even begin testing. And that happens all the time. Part of that is the function, as you put it, of the relationship of the laboratories to law enforcement. In most states and communities, the laboratory is part of the police department. And in Michigan, for example, more than half of the technicians at our forensic science laboratory were sworn officers who are evaluated in their jobs, not by scientists necessarily, but by a higher level police official. Does that impact the way they look at evidence or the way they view information brought to them? And the answer is it's human nature. Of course it does. So one proposal is to have laboratories be independent of the police, and to establish government laboratories that aren't connected with the law enforcement side, but are strictly scientific. The places that have started to do that are getting very good results. I would certainly support that, not because I think laboratory technicians or forensic scientists intentionally lie or intentionally shade their findings, just because I think it's human nature. And it's part of an unconscious bias that takes place by virtue of where they work and what they do.
Well, to kind of follow up on that, too, if I remember correctly from one of your works, there's even a bias towards the prosecution on the judge's part, isn't there, toward, or maybe I'm thinking of this from, I may be mixing this up with what I
no,
read
in the not.
Post
you're
about
not.
Weimar.
And I've written several papers about the issue of judicial bias in the admissibility of forensic science evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And the statistics are, frankly, that the government gets in evidence, forensic science evidence that it offers when contested over 90% of the time. The defense, when it offers forensic science evidence, gets its evidence admitted at a much lower rate, sometimes as low as 28% of the time. And the studies vary, but those numbers are radically different. Why is that? Is it because the government's forensic science evidence is better? Well, not according to either the National Academy of Sciences or according to the exonerations that we've had. Another reason, and I think this is a valid reason, is that the defense lawyers aren't raising the issues or doing a very good job of contesting it. And that's true. Many defense lawyers still don't understand enough about the validity or invalidity of forensic science to even present the issue to the judge. But at the third level, we as judges, partly because of our training, partly because of our own contextual bias, judges routinely admit virtually all forensic science evidence that's offered by the prosecution. Why is that? Well, part of it certainly is that in 38 of our states, judges are elected. And they are, consciously or not, responsible to a tough-on-crime electorate that favors the prosecution in criminal cases. But there are other more basic reasons. And I think the biggest one is that we were taught to preserve the status quo. My latest book is Forensic Science Evidence, Can the Law Keep Up with Science? And I was talking to the dean of the law school shortly after it came out, and he said, I saw your book and the subtitle, Can the Law Keep Up with Science? The answer is no. What are the other 250 pages about? The reason he was so quick to say no is because the law always looks backward. Science is always looking forward for answers, for new questions even. But the law teaches us that we should look backward for all of the answers. It's a doctrine called stare decisis or precedent, that we think if a question comes before us as a judge, what we need to do is look up the law, meaning how did judges before me decide this question? And then that'll tell me the answer, because I'm supposed to do it the same way the judges already did. As I say, if we left it to the legal system, the earth would still be flat, because that's what we're taught, which is to look backward, which means preserve the status quo. Now, there's some good reasons why the law does that. It promotes stability and predictability in the law, but it also anchors us to the past in a way that's not conducive to really conducting a real examination of the question. When we say, Judge, I know we've always admitted bite mark evidence in the past, but it's no longer valid. Well, judges, because of our training, don't want to be the first judge or even the second or third to say, oh, I'm going to look at this again. Maybe all those other judges were wrong. That's not in the nature of the law. It's in the nature of science, but not the law. And that leads to a bias in favor of whatever the status quo was and is.
Well, I think there's another flip side of this that we should also look at, to be fair, and not just beat up on social science majors. I was one, by the way.
so was I.
it seems to me that the public equates current scientific knowledge with the truth, and that's not always the case either, because science, as you mentioned, is constantly challenging previously held ideas. It works just in the opposite way of saying maybe we should take another look at this. So do you think this creates problems when new forensic science studies, like we had John Lentini on one of our shows, where, you know, really demonstrating that if you use scientific methods, you can toss out a lot of the way arsons have been investigated.
Exactly.
In the past. Is our criminal justice system, well, we've I guess pretty much talked about this, but so it's not really set up to handle that, is it, then?
Well, I think it is, but I do think that you have a point about jurors, because that's where the social science comes to bear. Jurors today do think that science can be a tremendous, and technology can be a tremendous aid in the search for truth. I'm not sure that all of them believe that science is always true, and I've even had jurors express the feeling that, in spite of all of the scientific evidence, they would believe an eyewitness over a forensic science expert. Jurors still do believe in eyewitness testimony, even though it's probably the most unreliable form of evidence that we have, but that's a social phenomenon. Beyond that, though, I think jurors who represent our real society do think that, and I think rightly so, that this search for science, the search in science, can be a search for truth. Not always the truth, but can be a search for truth. And I've reached the point where, as I said earlier, I think we need to accept the culture as it is and proceed on that basis if we're going to get the proper result in our criminal justice system, not to sit around as prosecutors want to do and bemoan the state of our culture. That doesn't get justice in any way.
Well, since we have, you know, all these little issues like, you know, standardizing forensic science, creating independent labs, future research and techniques, and developing new techniques, et cetera, and on the other side of the coin, there's almost no money available for it. So how do you see us getting through this tunnel and getting to the light, so to speak?
Yeah, what a great question. Jan mentioned that the National Academy of Sciences report was 6 years ago. And since that time, virtually none of the recommendations in that report have been adopted. So if we're going to wait for Congress or the states to act, these 6 years have told us it's going to be a very long wait, that there are a lot more priorities in the legislature at the federal and state level than making sure that these criminals get a fair trial or contesting our forms of forensic science evidence. The prosecutors, the District Attorneys Association, has effectively lobbied against any of the recommendations of the National Academy of Sciences that would impact the current admissibility that they get of virtually all the prior forms of forensic science evidence. So to answer your question, I think if we wait for legislation to approve either the substance or the money for changes in our forensic science evidence system, we'll be waiting an awful long time. What else could happen? Judges could start demanding more evidence of reliability in these cases and not admitting the evidence. As you probably gathered, I'm somewhat skeptical that change is going to take place. What I do think is that the real hope for better evidence and better forensic science evidence lies with juries, and that what will happen, and the Casey Anthony trial was a good example,
exactly.
What will happen is that jurors will start demanding better and better forms of scientific evidence, or they will not convict a person. And when that happens, then the prosecution will change and our system will change so that we'll get better forms of forensic science evidence and jurors can better make the decision that's going to dramatically alter a lot of people's lives.
Great answer.
Well, thank you, Donald Shelton, for helping us to make the public more aware of some of these problems and challenges before us. We really appreciate the time you spent with us today and look forward to talking to you again sometime, I hope.
Well, thank you, Jan, and thank you, Doug. This program does a great public service, even though you invited me on it. This program does a great public service, and I commend you for doing it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.